the reasons why the election has been so disputed and why there's such a relatively even number of votes, perhaps this has to do with the fact that the positions of the two candidates on the most burning political issues are so close as to be indistinguishable. And I say this because the theme this evening is political repression. And I want to talk a little bit about the death penalty and about the relationship between the rise of a vast prison system with connections in the corporate economy. It used to be that when an execution took place, it was news. Now, no one pays attention. Here in the state of Illinois, of course, your governor, your Republican pro-death penalty governor, issued a moratorium last January 31st. When Governor Ryan issued the moratorium here in Illinois, 13 wrongful convictions had been overturned. In other words, there had been as many death penalty cases overturned as there had been executions over the last 13 years. What I want to suggest this evening is that as important as the current campaign against the death penalty may be, it can, in fact, reverberate against us unless we conduct it within the context of understanding the relationship between capital punishment and the rise of a prison industrial complex. I say this for one because, in general, the alternative to death is proposed as what? Life sentence without possibility of parole. Now, what does this mean? It means that if we do manage to abolish the death penalty, which we should, and if we don't at the same time argue against and organize against mandatory minimums and the increasing lengthening of sentences, that there will be many, 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 many more people behind bars than there are now. Because only a small fraction of people actually charged with capital crimes receive the death penalty, right? Or they're not. Only a small percentage of people who are charged with what is conceivably a capital crime are actually charged with the possibility of a death penalty. The vast majority of people charged with possibly capital crimes don't have to go through the death penalty trial phase. So it means that it's quite possible that that whole class of people will be treated even more repressively if we don't link the two issues, the death penalty and the prison industrial complex. The question is not whether the death penalty should be abolished. The question is why we need to dismantle capital punishment. And if we can understand that question, then it might be possible to bring in another kind of abolitionism into a conversation with death penalty abolitionism. Maybe we can talk about death penalty abolitionism and prison abolitionism at the same time. I mean, that's what I basically want to suggest this evening. And let me tell you why I fear that the current death penalty campaign may reverberate against us. People are learning how to say that no one should be on death row who is innocent, right? I mean, the category of innocence now is moving toward center stage. So what is fair administering of the death penalty? I mean, what is that about? What is the context within which the state should be allowed to kill anyone? I mean, what is the context of fairness and equality there? I don't know. I guess Bush was saying that the fact that they're going to kill two of the men who killed James Byrd is an example of equality, is an example of racial equality. But I have a serious problem with that. Now, this category of innocence that has moved to center stage is dangerous. It is dangerous because increasingly in popular discourse, there is an understanding that it is possible to provide scientific proof of innocence, right? And what is that scientific proof of innocence? DNA. DNA. And I'm, you know, not suggesting that Barry Check has not done important work, but when DNA becomes the only means with which one can establish one's innocence, so many cases don't even involve DNA. And now, as a matter of fact, I mean, I know for a fact that many prisoners are just sort of grasping at straws and want DNA tests. And DNA is not going to make a difference, regardless. Now, it seems to me that there's also an ideology of innocence that we need to examine. Because what does innocence mean? It means that there must be some correspondingly guilty people walking around. And those guilty people must be in the free world, right? And so therefore, if the innocent person is taken off death row, it must be compensated by finding the guilty person who is then is the real person who should be killed. I mean, the point that I'm making is that we need to, particularly during this period, think very deeply and critically. Because if one looks at the history of the prison system and at the history of punishment in general, capital punishment included, it seems that during virtually all moments of reform, what has ultimately happened is that the system itself has been strengthened. And I'm not suggesting that this is a comment about reform in general. I'm specifically talking about prison reform. Because as a matter of fact, the prison came about as a result of a reform movement. The Quakers proposed the prison as an alternative to the death penalty. And this is really bizarre that we got the prison, but we also got a death penalty that has become even more barbaric than it was in the 18th century or 19th century when the prison was established. We began to recognize the importance of moving from campaigns around political prisoners to an understanding of the political role of the prison in general. And as a matter of fact, during that period, I'm talking about the period which saw the assassination of George Jackson, the uprising at Attica, uprisings in prisons all over, the strike at Folsom. One of the key demands was to abolish the indeterminate sentence. At that particular time, we were campaigning against the indeterminate sentence law. Because, of course, I mean, how could a person receive a sentence ranging from 1 year to life? It was very clear that that was a repressive mechanism, a repressive punishment practice designed to force prisoners to be the model prisoner, knowing that the only hope they would ever have of leaving prison would be if they obeyed in this very authoritarian way every demand of the guards. Well, what happened was that eventually the indeterminate sentence law was abolished. And what appeared to be a victory, or what we had imagined at the time as a victory, helped to lay the basis, to lay the foundation for truth in sentencing. And for these draconian sentences, such as life without possibility of parole, or 25 years without possibility of parole. You know, not 2 to 10, but 10 years. Not 1 to life, but life. Not, you know, 5 to 40, but 40. And this is where we are at the moment. So I'm suggesting that as we develop our demands and as we, you know, organize our campaigns, we think very seriously about the possible repercussions. And I say this particularly in relationship to the death penalty. So maybe we ought to start thinking about radical alternatives to the capitalist system. So the question is, how can we develop a critique of the death penalty, an analysis of the death penalty, against the backdrop of some kind of opposition to global capitalism? And how can we work our understanding of the prison system into that? That we rarely think about, you know, what is happening around the world is a direct result of the profit-generating activities of corporations that are largely based in the U.S. What about the prison industrial complex? Well, first of all, we have to talk about the prison as a slave plantation, and that, as a matter of fact, the slavery and the aftermath of slavery helped to form the prison, the punishment system in this country as it is today. And when one looks at the private exploitation of prison labor, we have to connect that with the convict lease system that developed in the aftermath of the Civil War, a system that was designed to manage black labor that was had just been recently set free, right? To re-enslave free black labor. But I also think it is important to say prison industrial complex. And the reason I think it's important to say prison industrial complex is because in that way we can evoke the sinister alliances that link increasing numbers of private corporations, and not just the private corporations that are directly involved in punishment, but all of the corporations that we basically count on to produce the commodities that we use in our daily lives. So many corporations have links directly or indirectly to the process of punishment, which means that these expanding prisons are occupying a central place in the economy. And see, that is what is really scary, because it's not only these ideological arguments about who is the criminal and who isn't. It's not only about, you know, constructing criminality in the way that it has been done racially, but it's also about making money. It's also about creating this machine in a very similar way as the military industrial complex is still with us. I mean, even though there is no more Cold War, look at all of the weapons that are continuously being constructed. Now we're talking about globalization, right? And if you look at the way in which the prison is playing a key role in globalization, let me just give you an example. Let me give you a couple of examples. One example is this. When I visited Australia 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, I was really surprised to learn that what was then the largest women's prison in Australia was owned and operated by a company that was headquartered in Nashville, Tennessee. And, you know, I've said this many times, but I think it's really important to realize what that means, that Corrections Corporation of America, fortunately, as a result of a movement in Australia, they have a very powerful anti-prison movement there, a very powerful abolitionist movement in Australia. And that's sort of interesting because Australia was initially a penal colony, right? And so most of the white Australians who live there are descendants of convicts, right? So some of them now have taken up the issue of prison abolitionism. But I have visited prisons all over the world. I have visited prisons in, well, in Australia, but also in Brazil, in Argentina, in Sweden, in the Netherlands. As a matter of fact, every time I leave the country, I try to visit a prison. Because those are the places we never think about. You know, they are everywhere. And everywhere, they're almost the same. And that sameness is a direct result of the fact that the United States of America is responsible for the proliferation of prisons all over. And for the idea that imprisonment is the only form of punishment that matters or that works. And it doesn't work. I mean, history demonstrates that imprisonment does not work. Because there's always been this strange shift from, well, prisons work because they rehabilitate. That's what the Quakers said when they first introduced the penitentiary. And I was talking about the era of globalization, the fact that new technologies of punishment travel the globe at an incredible speed. When was the first time you heard about a supermax? You know, let's create prisons that are on permanent lockdown. So control units, security housing units, and then whole prisons, super maximum security prisons. Well, there are supermaxes increasingly in other countries as well. A country like the Netherlands, Holland, which has long had a policy of decarceration. As a matter of fact, they have tried to make sure that each year they have fewer people in prison than more. And they have a prison system that allows people to go out and work. They have what they call closed prisons. They have half-open prisons, which means that you can go home on the weekends. And then they have open prisons, which means that you go to work during the day, you come back and sleep at the prison at night, and then on the weekend you go home and they close the prison down. I mean, everybody goes home on the weekend. So, I mean, they have an interesting system there. But even in the Netherlands, they have now a new super maximum security prison. In South Africa, they have a supermax. So just as the original model of the prison traveled the globe in connection with the marketing of democracy, you know, so now these ever-increasing technologies of punishment are being marketed. It's very interesting, I often point out that Corrections Corporation of America, the private prison corporation, was started with money from Massey Birch, the funders of Kentucky Fried Chicken. And there's a similarity between the way they approach their international marketing process, basically create the same product and market it all over the world. So just as now, you know, you can go anywhere in the world almost and you see Starbucks, right? I mean, it looks like an invasion from another planet. Wherever you go, no matter, you know, what the language, what the culture, you see Starbucks everywhere. I'm just afraid that we may find ourselves in a similar situation with the prison. That everywhere we go, that's what we see. And of course, the prison industry, I like to talk about the prison industry because I think the prison industry produces prisoners. And it produces precisely the kinds of prisoners that will keep the whole system in perpetual motion. It not only produces prisoners in the sense that it creates the kinds of prisoners that it wants, but it creates the conditions that cause increasing numbers of people to go to prison. When the funds are siphoned off from education, and when the schools cannot be developed because so much of the money is going into corrections, then those students, instead of acquiring knowledge, are basically only discipline. Because if you have a class, I mean, if you have to teach a class of, you know, 30, 40 students, and you're told that you have to keep the students in order, what do? You use precisely the kinds of techniques that come out of managing prison populations in order to keep the students in order. And then, of course, they learn how to basically be under surveillance in that way. They learn to be disciplined, and therefore they're learning how to be prisoners. They're headed, so the schools then, precisely because they cannot develop by virtue of the fact that funds are siphoned off from education, then end up replicating a system and at the same time contributing to the growth of that system. So the prison plays a pivotal role in producing the conditions of poverty that create a perceived need for more prisons. If funds, instead of going into health care or psychological health care, go into prisons, and what happens to people who need emotional assistance or who need psychological assistance? They're put in jail. It's a perpetual machine. As Joel Dyer said, it's a perpetual prisoner machine. And the prison system, the prison itself, is a breeding ground for racism. It's a breeding ground for sexism. It's a breeding ground for homophobia. It is amazing the extent to which you can more clearly see the problems we live with in the free world. I am really concerned that we link the struggles in which we are involved. That prisoners be acknowledged. You know, what often happens is that when people begin doing work around prisoners or even the death penalty, they tend to see the people who are in prison as these sort of pitiful creatures who need their help. So there's this missionary approach. And in the process, the men and the women on death row, the men and the women in all of the prisons across the country are objectified. They are, and those who do engage in that process end up doing on another level exactly what the state is doing to people who are behind bars. So it has been important to directly involve prisoners and directly involve young people. But I do want to say that I think we're at another moment now, in terms of our campaigns against the prison industrial complex. Radical movements have helped to produce a new vocabulary. 10 years ago, we wouldn't be talking about the prison industrial complex. We'd probably be talking about crime and punishment. So we're increasingly learning that we have to unhook crime and punishment, that punishment happens not primarily because of crime, but in connection with a whole range of other reasons. There are more popular representations about the death penalty and prisons. And I want to say that as the kind of resistance that we've mounted becomes increasingly legitimate, it is incumbent upon us to find ways of radicalizing that resistance. But it seems to me that if you believe in justice and equality, and perhaps also socialism, because I don't want to give that up. You know, perhaps we can say that the failure to clearly elect a president has carved out a political space that we now need to fill with our own demands. In fact, we can interpret this present moment as a message that we cannot leave our future in the hands of either candidate. We need to take it up ourselves, and regardless of who is designated what they sometimes call the leader of the free world, we need to demonstrate what it really means to engage in the practice of freedom. Thank you.